This is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and be sure to check us out on our blog, www.italiangenealogy.blog, and our great sponsors, Your Dolce Vita, Italy Rooting, and Abitivo Casa. And I'm thrilled to have a very special guest today from the Chicago area. He's an author and been working in the Italian community, I think, for about 60 years, Dominic Candeloro. So welcome, Dominic. Thanks for being here.
Nice to see you, Bob.
So, you know, I want to start with, because I think I read that your parents came from Italy, correct? Not like myself or my grandparents came.
Oh, yes. My mother came as a child in 1914. She's a five-year-old child. My father came as a 27-year-old veteran of World War I from Casale in Abruzzo.
So what year was that?
1925.
So was that just before they put that, you know, with the restrictions on, or was he able to get in?
Well, as a matter of fact, it was after. And as a matter of fact, he was illegal. And in fact, he was doubly illegal. For some reason, I haven't figured it out. I never asked, he never told, but he went to Cuba first and stayed for a while. It might have been a couple of years in Cuba. And then he took a ship from Cuba to New Orleans in August of 1925, and he was a clandestine, an illegal stowaway, and they caught him. And at first, in my first research, I thought they caught him and let him go, but now I found more information. They actually deported him back to where he came from. But a couple of weeks later, he came in on the same ship, and I don't know how he did it, but they didn't catch him. And he ended up in Chicago a little bit later and worked there for about 7 or 8 years before he married my mother in Chicago Heights.
That's so interesting. That's funny. So was he able to become a legal citizen, or it didn't matter?
Oh, well, it did matter. He married my mother. Maybe he married her for her citizenship. She gained citizenship naturally when she was born because my grandfather was a citizen. But during the 1930s, my father did apply for citizenship, but they didn't let him have it. He was studying for it, but when World War II broke out, he was declared an enemy alien. And then I now have new records that have just come through of a number of hearings that took place in downtown Chicago to investigate his status. And since he was without papers, he was they prevented him from getting it. They set up something for him to go to Canada and to apply for citizenship to the U.S. consul there, but somehow there was a problem with his employment, and they did not certify it. So he did not get his citizenship until 1947. And we're pleased that it happened, but it was a big rigmarole, and it was a big worry factor all during World War II. He was going down to downtown Chicago for several hearings, and they were threatened. He stayed in. He stayed out of trouble because if he were deported, then my mother and the rest of the family would be very adversely affected. And there was some ruling that if you were, if your deportation meant gross negative consequences for American citizens, like your wife and children, then they would hold up on that, all other things being equal. But he had a good record, but he had to get people to vouch for him. And they sent out investigators who took testimony from neighbors that he was a good person, hard worker, and all that sort of thing.
Wow, that is so, so interesting. Wow, that's a fantastic story. You know, my mom's parents, they were both enemy aliens, you know, when it first started. And by the end of the war, they had four sons in the service. Thankfully, they all came back. And but my uncle, who was left behind, he had to come through Canada in the late 40s, early 50s.
Yeah. Well, I always say the World War II was the most important thing that happened with Italian Americans, because first of all, they were rejected as enemy aliens. And then just a few months later, that was dropped because they needed to draft the million Italians who served in World War II. They served, and the average service was about 30-some months. And that was 30-some months of intensive Americanization. And then once they got out of the service, they got the GI Bill, and they were veterans, so they got bumped up in the middle class in some respect. So it was bad, and then before it got better. And it got significantly better into the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, my dad, he enlisted. He was in the army. He wanted to be a combat photographer, but they told him he didn't have the background yet as a photographer. But they told him they were going to send him to Signal Corps school in not far from where I live now, Monmouth, New Jersey, and that the life expectancy for a combat photographer was 6 months. So he would get his chance. But what happened was,
I rethink that.
Yeah. No, he still wanted to do it. And he, as soon as he went into school, he became a technical sergeant rating. But he had a punctured eardrum. So they discharged him. And because all the photographers in New York, or most of them, were in the service, he became a photographer at the Daily News very quick.
Oh, okay.
And he did that until after the war, when the photographers came back, and then he was a newsreel photographer for WPIX, and then later on he was back to doing photography for the New York Daily News.
Yeah, well, we haven't had the full scale war since World War II, but that sent all of society into a whirlwind. A lot of things were possible, both good and bad, for the participants.
Yeah, absolutely. So what did your father do? What was his?
Oh, he was a construction laborer all the rest of his life. Fairly low status. He was a member of the laborers union, famous for its corruption and all that, Las Vegas hotels, whatnot. But he ended up getting a pretty nice pension in the 1970s and 1980s when he retired. So as bad as they were a benefit to him and the family in his retirement.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com. Those, I say this all the time, you know, my uncles were all hardworking men, good family men. I'm very proud of that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it was humble work, and he never did speak English properly. And some funny stories that I often tell. My father, when I was about 12 or something, I was helping my father fill out his timesheet for the week and where he worked and all that. And he said, Well, on Tuesday, I worked in the whorehouse. You worked in the whorehouse? And it turns out you worked in the warehouse. And then he'd go he couldn't tell the difference between Tuesday and Thursday. He said, on the second Tuesday, I worked, he thought there were two Tuesdays in the week, Tuesday and the second Tuesday. he worked at another place. And so, and he never could tell the difference. He'd look at television when sports was on. He said he couldn't tell the difference between basketball, football, and baseball. It was all the same to him. So he never really Americanized to that extent. He was always an outsider. And one of the feelings that I had was growing up was that my contemporaries had more Americanized fathers who were knew about sports and that sort of thing. Not my father. He had a garden. He spent all of his time working in the garden, and the hell with the sports world. He had no use for that.
Yeah, well, that was probably smart, I suppose. But as a kid, I could see what you mean. So now I know you've been active in the Italian American community for, like I said, I guess 60 years or more.
Since the 70s, especially, yeah.
Yeah, so what spurred that on? I mean, what got you so excited about that?
There were a lot of things. When I was growing up, it was in the shadow of World War II, and when anybody referred to Italy, they usually used the term war-torn Italy. This sort of thing happened. They're starving there. My mother and father were making up packets to send to Italy. We were sending spaghetti. We were sending coffee. We were sending our old shoes and our old clothes. What the hell kind of a country was it that needed our old clothes and needed to have food from us, who we considered ourselves poor? And and nobody at that time traveled to Italy. None of the immigrants traveled to Italy in the 50s. They didn't want to go back. Why would they ever want to go back? Everything about America was so much better. That was the thought of it. Italy was not a place to admire. Being an Italian American was not a plus. In schools, the teachers did not say, "Oh, how wonderful you have your parents speak Italian to you at home. How wonderful you could have two cultures. You know how wonderful the Italian culture is, the Renaissance artists and all that." Nobody ever said that. No teachers ever said that to me. I went to a school that was mostly Italian American kids, and we had a culture within our own group, and we weren't really proud to be Italian. We knew Italian. We knew most of the cuss words, there was no desire to learn Italian language. Our parents were not equipped to teach us Italian. Although I think my father had a little bit better education in Italian schools. He went to the fifth grade, and then he was in the military and got some training there. But it was not really possible. I went to Northwestern as an undergraduate and on a scholarship. And I took French classes. French was kind of chic in the mid-50s because the American GIs had spent some time in France, and French culture was, and French language were considered, were respected and loved at that time. I should have taken Italian. My whole career would have been so much better if I had some formal education in Italian. I can always understand basic household conversation in Italian, but the rest of it, no. And there was no big effort to teach me Italian on the part of my parents or anybody else. But I had studied Latin in high school. And in college, I guess I was, it was a sophomore, I went to see La Dolce Vita. And I saw a different Italy than I had ever imagined. There's nothing more, except for there are some segments of La Dolce Vita that did treat the village life. But the modern part of Italy in the movie La Dolce Vita were really striking to me. And I said, oh, this takes, there's another look. And I saw the movie four or five times, and I brought friends to see it. And it is a landmark in my life. I got much more interested in Italy. And then in graduate school, pretty far along, I trained as an American historian of the 20th century, and I focused on Chicago. I did a biography for my dissertation of Lewis F. Post, who was an editor of a progressive newspaper in Chicago from 1898 to 1914 or something. And when I was in the latter stages of my graduate student career at the University of Illinois in Champaign, Rudolph Vaccoli joined the faculty. He was hot stuff at that time. He had recently written an article challenging Oscar Hanlon, the Harvard historian, who had talked about the brutal filter that all the ethnic groups had gone through, all the immigrants had gone through, that had decimated their cultures and melted the immigrants. Well, Vaccoli had, he was at the University of Wisconsin for graduate work, and he had done this dissertation on Italians in Chicago. And his research showed a much slower melting, and in fact, in many cases, almost no melting of the people that he interviewed and that he visited. And instead, he emphasized that Oscar Hanlon had greatly emphasized that brutal filter. And so this was the beginning of a new appreciation for the continuity of ethnicity. And this is about the same time that the book came out about New York. It was a shift in the scholarship on immigration away from the old melting pot toward an appreciation that ethnicity has still played a very big role in American politics, American economics. So he was at the forefront of this. This was in the mid-60s he came to the University of Illinois. And I worked as his research assistant for a while. And in the 1966, I think, it was December of 66, he went to the American Historical Association meeting. And at that meeting, there was a side meeting with a bunch of very prominent Italian-American scholars and they formed the American-Italian Historical Association. And he was the first president of the organization. Little was I to know that I did a little bit of research on other ethnic historical associations and on the kinds of things that they did. And with the outcome for him was that any association that he headed would not be So filio-pietistic, that was the term, filio-pietistic. It wouldn't just be a PR organization for the Italian Americans, but be a real academic organization that just happened to focus on Italian Americans, and the fact that a lot of the people were Italian Americans shouldn't change their points of view or influence things too much. They were to be scholars first. Anyhow, I in the 1970s, I had an opportunity. I was at a seminar on what's it, quantitative history at the Newberry Library in the 70, I guess it was 77 or 7, it was 76 or 77, at the it was in the summer, and I had accepted a job in Lubbock, Texas, to teach American history. It wasn't a very good one, but it was reasonable. I accepted that job. But then word came that the University of Illinois Chicago needed a person to teach Italian American history and culture. And I, in a very hurried way, I went and applied for it, and they offered it to me, and I gave up Lubbock, Texas. This is all my life and the life of all my kids would have been changed if we'd have gone to Lubbock, but we didn't. We stayed in Chicago, and the rest is history. The teaching at the it was the Chicago Circle campus, which happened to be in a an area that was raised, an Italian American neighborhood that was raised in order to build the university. So the university has this sort of a guilt complex. But in any case, a club called the Italian American Executives of Transportation put up the money, I think it was like $20,000, to pay a professor, which turned out to be me, to teach Italian American history. And I did it for about 5 years there. And in the middle of it, I got involved with the American Italian Historical Association. And they had begun a project to do a major history of an Italian Americans in one of the big American cities. And I eventually became the executive director of that, wrote the grant proposal and became the executive director. And we had about $300,000 to document and share the history of the Italians in Chicago. And that turned out to be a project with 100 oral histories that were typed, taped, and delivered. That were we did a co major collections effort in with about 20 or 30 different workshops around the city and the Italian community to collect photos, documents, and memorabilia. Ultimately, we put together an exhibit at the public library, Chicago Public Library, a cultural center downtown, and we had money. The money wasn't coming out of our ears, but we had money to hire people to do the interviews. We had money to hire people as assistants for this and that, and to fund exhibit design and all that. And that was a fantastic period of activity. Every night I was out in the community at one club or another, asking them to give us their stuff. And we did create an archive of Italian American history in Chicago that is at the University Chicago UIC. And so that was a very stimulating thing. And I don't know of any other. It was a public programming and an academic effort. It wasn't just here's a few hundred thousand dollars to do something that's totally academic that will result in the publication of a book or two. This was reaching out in the community. And well, we got some criticism from the academics for not being so strictly academic. And we got some criticism from the Italian-American people for being too academic. So we were right in the middle there. In any case, after that, the family went to Italy for a Fulbright year, and that was a fantastic thing. And into the 1980s, I stayed close to the American-Italian Historical Association. I served as in various places, and I ran four conferences that took place in Chicago. I was the president. I was the vice president, a newsletter editor, and whatnot. And in 2000, I was appointed as the executive director of the organization. And in that position, I did a lot of different things. I helped with create conferences in some major cities we hadn't attended. And we did an exhibit in 2005 at the National Archives in Rome about immigration not to be forgotten. And I got materials from 10 different American cities and scholars in those cities, mostly photographs, to illustrate the Italian experience in their towns. So I've been involved with the Italian Cultural Center in Stone Park since about 1977, I've probably organized 1,000 programs, whether they were 10 or 15 people together or conferences for 350 people over 3 days at a major hotel on Italian American studies. It's been fun. It's a lot of work and a mixture of scholarship. I've written some things that I'm really proud of. I've written a lot of press releases. I've created a lot of flyers for events. I've been editor of a couple of anthologies about Italians in Chicago. One is called Reconstructing Italians in Chicago. And that was started as a conference in 2008 that took place in Chicago. And then in 2014, we put together a book on Italian women in Chicago. That was a big success. And I've written Arcadia books, you know, mostly pictures on the Italians in Chicago. For a while, I was assistant to the mayor of Chicago Heights, and we did the history of Chicago Heights as one of the first Arcadia books that came out in 1999, I think. And since Chicago Heights is heavily Italian, that ended up being a lot about the history of Italians in Chicago. And then the Arcadia people did, first they did just picture books, then they did something that turned out to be like interview books or oral history books, then they did these heavier narrative books. So I've got a couple of narrative books in the Arcadia series. And altogether, I've done 8 or 9 Arcadia books, some with co-authors, but mostly myself. So It's been a lot of work. I enjoyed it, though, so it wasn't such hard work.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic career. And you know what's interesting about what you said is, you know, around the same time, Anthony Riccio, and I don't know if you ever heard of Anthony. He passed away a couple of years ago. I don't know if you know that, but he was doing virtually the same thing, interviewing Italian American or Italians that immigrated to the United States, who came in the early 1900s, who are now in their 70s. And, you know, he's had several books on the oral histories, which was the way they communicated, right? They didn't write. Yes. They did it orally.
Yeah. Well, I met him. I went with my wife to a conference that took place in Boston. And my business to go and visit him. He worked for Yale, the Yale Library, and he's done some similar things. Some of it much more serious than the stuff that I've done, and we had a good friendship. And I was really sad to see him go. And actually, you know, he had a nice job at the Yale Library, but he should have had a job as professor of Italian American Studies at Yale. And since Yale is in a community that is so heavily Italian American, they should have been one of the leaders in Italian American Studies.
Yeah, you know, I met him. Just, you know, I found them, I guess I was just, sometimes I just Google things and look for people, and he looked interesting, and he was just so gracious, and I met a couple of really good friends through him. But he was such a wonderful guy, and he kind of helped me with some ideas about, you know, the book that I wrote. Just a sad, sad loss for the Italian community, the Italian American community. Yeah. But I'd like to ask you, what's your concern about the future for the third and fourth and fifth generation Italian Americans now, who are so disconnected, you know, unlike us who grew up hearing Italian and being around family? What are you worried about?
Well, I have some. A nephew who lives in California, his son is an all-American kid. He is, I don't think he's anywhere, the only, I don't think he has any real awareness of his Italian background. Oh, there's some stuff about Italian food and Italian food traditions that this family keeps. And I think that's wonderful. And they visited Italy. And when they visited Italy, he played soccer with the guys in the town and made a connection there. But I don't think he has any relationship to the I don't want to say poverty, but to the darker side of being an immigrant, to the challenge of being an immigrant. These are all sort of positives of the Italian culture that he participates in, but none of the pain of being an immigrant, part of an immigrant experience. And so they'll never know it, but the reason for the Italian Cultural Center here in Stone Park and Casa Italia and all that is to try and perpetuate some of the Italian culture and appreciation, that sort of thing, and carry on some of the traditions. But I don't know if that will succeed. The idea of having Italian American endowed professorships, I think we have to show the flag among academics so that they don't forget us altogether. The a recent, I mean, the university's interest in minority groups today does definitely not include Italian Americans. I always felt that we were part of the the underclass or whatever. Although I know that times have changed and Italians have prospered economically in a very fantastic way, I feel like the Italians did maybe in the 1920s when Sacco and Vanzetti were the object of the left wing or the intellectuals. Save Sacco and Vanzetti was the thing. Those poor Italians, those noble Italian workers. You don't hear that anymore. Italians are tough guys. They're the mafiosi. They're all very successful. They're right-wing politicians. They're whatnot. But they're certainly not people to be sympathized with and to try to understand. You hear on public radio, you hear people talking about social problems. Italian Americans are never social problems. They're never part of the solution. They're never part of the, well, they may be part of the problem in not wanting to change. But we are not a favored by the intellectuals. We're not a favored minority group. Anyhow, that thing has changed. The one glimmer of hope, I discovered family history. And I have been working on my family history for the past 2 years, starts and stops. And I probably did twice the work because I delayed so much. But I put together from photos, documents, memorabilia, and from research in genealogy, I put together something that's like a scrapbooky history of my family. And I went back to my grandparents, and maybe we've got names of my great grandparents there. That's a little hazy back there, but we have a pretty good accounting of the people who were important in my life. Now, it's not a great history of the Candeloro and Gianetti family. My mother was a Gianetti, her father a Candeloro. But I have I put this thing together. I published it on Amazon, and you, of course, know that Amazon does not charge you any upfront costs to publish on Amazon. And it's a very reasonable cost to buy author's copies. All you have to do is jump through all their hoops, and they got a lot of hoops. But you can produce a printed book, and it looks like any other book. And I did it. And I left a lot of blank pages because I didn't know everything. And I'm never going to know everything. Nobody's ever going to know everything. And there are other people in the family who might know. Let them fill in the blank pages. Let them get back to me. And you can always update an Amazon book by sending up another upload. And I think this will give our young people no reason at all not to know who their great-grandfather was. It's in the book, and there's a little bit of description of him. And there's and Family Search will give you almost instantaneously 20 documents about any person whose name you put in there. They'll then give you, lead you almost immediately to 20 different documents that were crucial in that person's life. You could use that. Family Search will help you create family trees. Does it with some precision. You've got to learn a little bit of Family Search. It's not totally easy, but things are a lot easier to do now than they used to be. And you could all do it all at home in your underwear.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, you know, and I always tell people to you know, if they're just starting out, to go to FamilySearch first. First of all, it's free. And like you said, you know, I like the way they build out the family better than Ancestry. I think it's easier to look at. You know, my book, Farmers and Nobles, is about, it's a little bit about my family history. It's a little bit about how I did my research. And it's a, you know, it's a little bit about some of the fantastic stories that I've heard when I'm interviewing people, because I don't think anything is an accident. You know, I think we're meant to find stuff.
Mm-hmm. And well, also an important thing that we've encouraged people at the Casa Italia Library to write their autobiographies, and one good way to do it, if you say, oh, I can't sit down and write anything, is to just do an iPhone video and upload it to YouTube, and then YouTube does a transcription. Now, it does copy all the ums and ahs. You do have to go through and kind of reconstruct the grammar a little bit, but you've got, you talk for an hour, you've got 20, 25 pages of a transcript of a text that in which you're telling your story. So you can recreate, you can't create a book by just talking with it, with YouTube.
Yeah, that's a great idea. You know, and I didn't even think about that. That's a fantastic idea and the way to do it. And I guess for people who don't like to type, it makes it quicker.
Well, it's a little bit tricky. I think YouTube keeps changing their rules or their format, what you're supposed to click on to access the transcription, but the transcriptions are getting better and better. That's one of the positives of AI, to do better transcriptions and voice to type. So there are a lot of ways which people can write their own stories. Now, these stories might not be bestsellers. They might not compete with the literature that maybe our professional writers of Italian background who do Italian studies, but they can save the history of our family, maybe the ordinary stuff that was going on, and maybe some of the extraordinary stuff that happened in some families. There's always some little bit of excitement, there are newspaper articles or clips that you could get about just anybody in the family. I found my sister, when she was in high school, was part of the Future Homemakers Association, and they had a state conference for high school kids, and she attended it, and that got into our local newspaper, and I was able to find this clip and put that, reproduce it in our family history. If you had a good local newspaper like we had in Chicago Heights, you can find those kinds of gems that talk a little bit about your family.
Well, and you know, I found my father was born in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. I still don't know why, how he wound up being born there. But, you know, I found the local paper there from the 1920s. And I actually found obituaries from some of my great-grandparents in Italy in this little tiny mid-New Jersey newspaper from 1927.
Yeah. Well, the Chicago Heights Star used to report on Little League games, on who the winning pitchers, who got three hits or four hits. And so you can recreate those moments from the past in your family. Sadly, those newspapers are gone. You probably have to search people's Facebook pages to find those kinds of references today.
Oh yeah, probably. And you know, to your point, I found that my aunt, my father's sister, they had things in there like She motored to Brooklyn, New York for vacation for 2 weeks in the summer of whatever, 1920 something. It's so amazing. So I used to spend a lot of time in Chicago. I worked for Chase. I used to go there, five, six times a year, sometimes for as much as a week. And I'm ashamed to say, as a New Yorker, that some of my favorite Italian restaurants were in Chicago.
Oh, well, restaurants change. Italian restaurants, especially, they're maybe a generation and a half, two generations at the most. Then they get smart and want to have professions that don't take up 26 hours a day, like the restaurant industry does.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean. I had gone to restaurant school in the late 1980s, and it's a job and a half. So one last thing for you, Dominic, before we go, what advice would you give to people? Where should people really interested in Italian American history, where should they go and look?
Well, first of all, go and see The Italian Americans, the special that was done by PBS in 2014, I think. It's about 3 hours long, but online they've cut it up into about 10, 14-minute segments or something. It's a base. It's a good base for going on into all the other things. And then there are the basic books. Everyone should read Christ in Concrete and Jerry Mangione's Montalegro for a taste of that generation in the 20s and in the 30s. And there's the big book, the Rutledge History of Italian Americans. If you get on further and if you're got some academic leanings, that's a great book to read. Actually, Arcadia Books has done 60 different picture books on Italians in you name the city. And we have them in the Italian Cultural Center Library, and there are 60 of them. And each of them has like 200 pictures of Italian-American life in that city. Online, there are some good treatments of Italian-Americans. One should join an organization. And in an organization, one should go beyond the social aspects that Italian-American organizations and give them Italian intellectual, historical, or cultural content. So go beyond that. Watch films. Go to see the latest La Dolce Vita. Go to see the other great Italian movies that have been produced. There must be 50 great Italian movies have been produced since World War II. To get a sense of it, visit Italy. Everyone who visits Italy wants to go back and they're planning their second trip. And Italy is not a one-trick pony or a two-trick pony or a three-trick pony. There's much more than Rome, Florence, and Venice in Italy. Every town, my mother's hometown, built their church in 1170, and they have been living there ever since, and a little history has been happening here and there, and every town, every place has traditions and landmarks in it there, so you can really get a lot out of visiting. The Italian language, of course, the language is the key to the culture, and my one regret in all this whole thing is that I never studied Italian language formally and rigorously as I should. I've been to Italy many times, and I can get along in Italian, but I am not a master of the language, and in my business, it would have helped a lot.
I know. I feel the same way. I wish the parents had taught us. I took a couple of classes in college way, way back, but you know, I certainly didn't remember anything. But yeah, that's one of my biggest regrets that I don't know the language. And you know, to your point, I tell everybody, if you go to Italy, you have to go to the hometown. If you don't go to the hometown, you haven't been in Italy.
I have I'm lucky that I have relatives and friends enough so that people ask me about what's the best hotel here and there. Hey, I don't know. I hardly ever stay in hotels in Italy.
Well, you know, and I my dad has first cousins there that I met that I don't know if he knew when he was alive that they were still alive. It just blew me away to find out that my father's first cousins were still alive in Italy. They're in their 90s, obviously, but it was just shocking.
Well, we went to Italy in June of this year, and we visited my father's hometown area. This is he's from Casoli in Abruzzo, and we had an Airbnb in Orsogna, which is about 10 miles away. And instead of us visiting family members, we invited them to visit us, and I brought copies of the family history and parts of the family history are in Italian, especially the parts that deal with my father. And so I did treat my father's branch of the family. We have a list of each one of his siblings and a little bit about them and their families. And so we presented it to them. We invited all the descendants of my grandparents who were married in 1894. And so we had a nice attendance. About 30 of them came, and they seemed to be interested in carrying forward and cooperating. And so we were very pleased with the possibility of getting them to contribute to the whole project in the future.
Yeah, and you know, I met a fourth cousin that when I first found my dad's mother's family. I had a first cousin that I found on Facebook, and she was just so great in helping me to find things and putting people together. And when we went to the hometowns, being there, and it's an incredible experience for people who haven't done it and are planning it. There's nothing like it for sure. Well, listen, Dominic, I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been fantastic, especially with the history of Italian Americans and how people can find them. And we'll have to chat some more.
Well, keep on working.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.